and welcome to the 94th episode of Lake of Rage, a Pokemon trading card game podcast. I'm your host, as always, Kevin Clementi, aka Mellow underscore Magikarp, and joined today by a very special temporary guest host. Joining us for the first time, we have a legend in the game, the one and only Sam Chen. Sam, how are you doing today?
Hey, Kevin. Happy to be here. That introduction was more than I deserved. Very happy to be on your podcast. Longtime listener, as I've told you in person, but very, very happy to come on today to talk about a very important topic.
I have to, before we do go on, you did come up to me Vancouver last year. At the time you're listening to this, you might be at Vancouver for this year, but Vancouver last year, you came up to me and I was with JP and stuff. So you, I guess, I didn't know it was next to each other already, but you're like, oh, yo, you're Mellow Magikarp. I love the podcast. And you're one of the people who, like, you were a huge name. And it's like, I was like so starstruck because when I first started, it was like, bro, that's Sam Chen. Like, he just said that he loves the podcast. I was like, thanks, bro. Like, I didn't know what to say from there. So that meant so much to me.
I legitimately enjoy listening to your podcast. I think you do, you know, you do a wide variety of topics, very interesting, and the guests are good, and you're a good facilitator as a host. And I do listen to almost every episode when YouTube recommends it to me, my recommended videos, I will click on it.
Shout out to YouTube for that one. And if you are listening on YouTube, be sure to hit subscribe so you get recommended those videos more frequently. But speaking of the wide array of topics, we have a very special one for you today. We're going to talk a lot about organized play and why it is seemingly terrible for the Pokemon trading card game. Sam, is that a correct adjective? Can you co-sign that one for me, or did I go too far?
Terrible is not the adjective I would use. I think the more political way to say it is there is plenty of room for improvement. It's a work in progress, if you will. But yeah, I mean, there are lots of shortcomings and general lack of transparency and lack of incorporation of player feedback, or even the solicitation of player feedback is, many, many problems that could potentially be solved.
See, y'all see why I invited Sam on this one. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and get in some Rapid Strike questions because it's the first time that he has joined us on the pod. Then we're going to get to know Sam a little bit, his history as a player, because it's a name that, you know, you just top 16 to OCIC. Congrats on that, by the way. But
thank you.
Some people might be like, oh, it's a name I'm kind of like seeing around, and not realize that there's a lot of other accomplishments in there and a long storied history in the game. So I want to talk about that a little bit. And then we're going to talk about how did organized play get to this point? What's been some of the history? Why are tournaments run the way they are? Why is the world's invite structure run the way it is? And then, of course, will things actually get better? Where is the light at the end of the tunnel realistically sitting for us as Pokemon trading card game players? Also, you'll notice that there was no podcast in your feed last week. Be sure to follow at Lake of Rage Pod on Twitter for updates, or just don't be surprised when there's the occasional one that's missing because I'm at a regional or something, or I'm raising a child and my wife is doing something else. So that's why I wasn't there last week. Be sure to follow the Twitter for that one. Are you ready for your Rapid Strike question, Sam?
There's no single strike or fusion strike questions I could have instead.
Unfortunately, no, I did not prepare any of those. So you're stuck with these.
I will do my best. I'll do my best not to embarrass myself.
Perfect. I don't know if you did listen to the episode we had Alex Cook on, but he got in 1 minute, I think, four questions answered. So you can beat that for sure.
Okay, I will try.
Perfect. So no explanation, straight off the dome, 60 seconds. Are you ready?
I am.
Question number one, winter or summer?
Oh, summer.
What's your favorite snack?
There's a Taiwanese snack called stinky tofu, and I love that.
What's your favorite retro format to play?
2017 Nats or Worlds.
Favorite deck
Sun
ever?
And Moon. The obvious answer is Repagar, but I would say Typhlosion Ninetales from back in the day.
Would you rather be late or be early?
I would rather be early, but I'm always late.
What's your favorite world's location?
Ooh, Hawaii for sure.
Super salad.
Soup.
Toppings on your perfect pizza.
I like Hawaiian, but I'm also Canadian, and that's a Canadian thing.
What color sleeves do you use?
Dragon Shield, blue, sky blue.
Juniper, sycamore, oak, rowan, or magnolia?
Oak.
And that
I have a good answer for that too.
Is that. Time. That's a perfect time to segue right. into then. Why? And oak is correct, but why oak?
Okay. So the reason I have oaks is because when I came back after I took a hiatus over COVID to get engaged and, you know, buy a house and all that fun stuff. And when I came back, I needed to buy cards and I knew Research was going to be a card that was going to be a staple. So I bought like 40 of them. And the Celebrations ones were like 6 cents each because so many people opened Celebrations for the Chase card. And like the next cheapest one was, I think, Rowan, because no one likes that art.
True.
Or actually, I don't remember if it was Rowan, but basically, oaks were 6 cents piece. And the nostalgia factor of oak being, you know, the OG discard draw seven effect. So I had to go with Oak's Research. Or not Oak's Research, but the Professor Oak art of Professor's Research.
And then for favorite deck, you said Drampa Garb is the obvious choice. Why is it the obvious choice? And then we'll get into why the other deck you picked.
Ah, sure. I had a pretty good run in the 2017-2018 season, primarily piloting Drampa Garb. This is when Guardians Rising first came out through that Worlds format. And so I had won a regional with Drampa Garb in Seattle, and then I had got third place at the North American International Championships, and then proceeded to get eighth place at Worlds, all with that same deck. And then a few months later, got top eight again at Vancouver Regionals with that deck. So it was in a string where of eight majors where I top eighted six of them, and probably my best individual streak in my life of in terms of Pokemon stuff.
What drew you to Drampa Garb? Because I didn't play Standard back then. By the time I played it, that deck was expanded only. So why was it so good? Why is it so fun?
So the full story is when Guardians Rising first came out. So I work with a group called X-Files, and one of those people on X-Files was Tyler Nunamira. And we had a forum where we just share deck lists, and Tyler had been testing this Drampa Garb deck. And I actually took it to a city championship in New York because I lived there at the time, and I wanted to sort of test pilot it to, you know, sort of report on how the deck functioned and how the results were in a sort of a live tournament. And I actually ended up winning that city championship with the Drampa Garb. And it was sort of a different list. We had like a Mewtwo EX in there, Mewtwo GX? EX.
The X-Ball.
No. The super regenerator one that healed.
Oh, yeah.
Healed damage. And the energy absorption. It was actually a counter to Sylveon. So you can heal 60 to get rid of the 110 damage from Sylveon, and then you can energy absorption to bring energy back so Sylveon can never hammer you out of energy. So like there's some different cards in the original list, but then at Seattle Regionals, you know, that deck had done really well at cities, and some of my teammates had also done pretty well in their city championships. So we thought, hey, this is probably the best deck in format. And you have to keep in mind, this is a time when information wasn't as freely available online. There weren't online tournaments every night, so you couldn't just go online and see a list. And so a lot of real life testing was sort of necessary. And so that's why we brought Drampa Garb to Seattle Regionals. Tyler and I actually played one card off. I just didn't believe in the Shaman, even though he thought it was necessary. And so I got first, he got third. Great event for all of us that played it. All of us got top 32 that played the list.
As you're speaking about this, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was going to say, I'm pulled up the Seattle Regionals and just looking at the list and the number of names that I recognize as a Seattle local of players who you recognize from the X-Files or possibly had the list from, you know, Tyler and whatnot is.
Yeah. I mean, it was for sure the best deck in the format. People were unprepared to play against Trash Lanch. Like Trash Land single-handedly killed Trainer's Mail as a reasonable card to play in a lot of decks. Mm-hmm. You know, every time my opponent would like Trainer's Mail for Ultra Ball or Trainer's Mail for VS Seeker, I'm like, oh, that's just plus 40 damage for me later in the game. And so I kept playing that deck through NAIC since for NAIC I tested everything, but it was the only deck that I felt comfortable with. And then for Worlds, again, I knew going into Worlds, this is the deck I have to play. Yeah.
So how were you able to, so you said people weren't prepared for it at Seattle Regionals, which is the same story I've heard. Anyone listening to this, go scroll through it, and there's a random Lapras, and then there's a Vespaquin, and then it's all Garbodor, like all the way down, right? How did you keep finding success if people eventually figured out how to play around Trashalanche?
Trashalanche is like, for many decks and archetypes, it's like impossible to play around Trashalanche. Mm-hmm. Not until Guardian DX came out was there sort of a reasonable way to, with Twilight GX, but not until Guardian GX came out was there a reasonable way to consistently, or a top deck to consistently not play items or retrieve those items from the discard. I think, you know, as much as you want to play around it, the Drampagar player can also be very defensive and move things and, you know, take the lines that are as defensive as possible. Like, for example, at NAIC, there was a game against Philip Schultz where I believe I Righteous Edged 7 or 8 times just to discard energy and pile damage on the field instead of taking knockouts. Mm-hmm. And I did that because he played a Zygarde, which I had no counter for. And so I basically could not take a prize until he had like 1 or 2 prizes left. And then I had to end and pray. so that was my entire strategy, is to not take prizes. And I think that's one of the things that made the deck difficult to play against, especially in an end toxin format, where toxin being the Garbutoxin Garbodor that could trainer lock if there was a tool attached to it. Ability lock. Wow, trainer lock with a tool would be insane.
Oh, yeah.
That could ability lock with a tool attached. And so with a deck that's naturally equipped to play end toxin, you had multiple modes. And unless your opponent knew exactly what they were doing, it was very difficult to play against. And there's also something else I did is I actually played 20 games against myself of Drampagar Mirror. So I learned that matchup inside. It was painful.
That's dedication right there.
It was horrible. But I learned the in and outs of the matchup and like when you're supposed to take prizes, when you're supposed to attack with Trubbish and Garbodor.
Mm-hmm. Was this acid spray?
Okay. Not with Garbodor, 70 damage, flip a coin if heads discard energy attack. Mm-hmm. I used acid spray like way more than people did, because sometimes you actually want to sacrifice your first Trubbish so your ends become a little more powerful. Mm-hmm. So you want to like chip damage, and especially like sometimes you knew the math of Drampa or Trash Lance hits later, like the 10 chip sometimes makes a difference. And if there's a 50-50 chance to force them to attach another energy card. So there's many control aspects to that deck, even though it's a take prizes deck. And so I think I just got better at playing it. And there was definitely some skill difference in terms of, you know, if you didn't know what you were doing against it, some matchups were almost like 90-10 against people who didn't know what they were doing. And then that same matchup could be like 55-45 if both sides were playing perfectly.
So you mentioned the Philip Schultz specifically, that matchup, but this kind of idea of this hand disruption is so important, right? Like giving up prizes so your ends are more like powerful, right? Because N is based off the number of prizes your opponent has left, and you, but number of prizes your opponent has less so they can draw less cards. This is something that we see all the time. Obviously, N doesn't exist anymore, but it's like, oh, Marnie's beating people, or a constant Marnie path spam or Judge path spam. How do you, as someone who knows you are a good player, so let's go back to 2017, Sam, right? So you know that you sit down, you're probably more skilled or experienced or whatever than most people are going to sit down against. How do you put down, like, I'm going to kind of prey a little bit on this hand disruption and bricking my opponent a little bit as a valid strategy to win the game? If that question made sense.
Yeah. I think I know what you're asking. So like specifically in that match against Philip Schultz, I found out game one, he played Zygarde, mm-hmm. Zygarde EX, which for fighting colorless did 60 damage with a choice band, did 90 damage times 2, 180 kills Drampa. And that's why he played it. Mm-hmm. So in that matchup, I can't win a traditional prize trade. I just can't. Like, there's no unless he prizes, like, do I go for the 10% chance he prizes Zygarde? Or maybe, let's just say, 5% chance that he prizes Zygarde and also doesn't get it off his first 3 prizes. Also, at that time, I knew the Schultz brothers liked to play town map. So also, I assume both Robin and Philip like doing it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, he might have town map in there as well to, like, dig the Zygarde out. So I just literally cannot start swinging with my normal strategy. I just have to go in and try to come from behind. So there's certain situations like that. Other times after a couple turns in a game, you just realize, hey, I'm down in prizes. If I just keep prize trading, I'm not going to win. So what I need to do is I need to target specific energy or attackers on their board with Lysander, mm-hmm. and then take that knockout. And then eventually, you know, he has to, or she has to attack with a worse attacker, and then that doesn't potentially one shot a Lele or a Drampa, and then I end them that turn. So really, like, if you can sort of map out the game in your head and you're going to be behind in tempo by a couple turns, or by a turn or two, then you sort of pivot your strategy and see, what do I give up, and you know, what do I want the board state to look like when I'm ending my opponent down the road. Mm-hmm. And back then, you know, decks played 4 Ultra Ball, 3 Lele or 4 Lele, like 4 N, 4 VS Seeker. So like what, a fifth of your deck, more than a fifth, almost a quarter, more than a quarter of your deck is ways to find N. Mm-hmm. So you can reasonably say, if I want to end my opponent any turn, I have access to that. And also to like answer sort of something you brought up, or respond to something you brought up a bit earlier about mm-hmm. the Marnie situation, I think there's a huge difference between N and Marnie, or Judge, in that Judge played on the very first turn with a Judge path. That's like a Marshadow let loose. And that card was banned for very good reason.
Yeah.
Whereas N is like giving your opponent a Cynthia. So like, it's having, you know, after the draw for turn, having access to 5 cards versus 7 cards sometimes makes a huge difference. Like, Cynthia is a card, shuffle, draw 6, that people voluntarily played in their deck because it was like a very, very good supporter. People played 4 of that card. So N, really, you don't have to, you choose when you get to a position to get N into, you know, nothing. Or into low number of cards, and you can, many games you can sort of, I mean, sometimes you can't control it because you just have to go for it.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can really control, like, I'm not going to take this prize. And something else that potentially helped in that format was that it was a 2 prize format a lot of the time. EX prizes were, the 2 prizes were 2 shots often. Sometimes obviously there was 1 shots happening, but it's mostly a 2 shot format. And in that 2 shot format, you can actually choose when to take the knockout. Right? You can say, I'm not going to take this knockout. I'm going to Lysander hit that other thing. So I'm not losing any damage. I guess Parallel City can heal, many other things can heal. But in theory, I can, you know, I can snipe something else without having to take prizes. And in sort of one-shot formats, that's less possible to control, as we have sort of today.
That makes sense. Yeah, there was no Amazing Rare Veltal to just say you're knocked out, or Quad Power Tablet, Cross Fusion Strike, Technoblast, right? Like, that's slightly different.
Yeah, the wild thing was, like, in that Nats format, the closest thing to a one-shotter was Drampa. And to get a one-shot, you need not only 3 energies attached, you need a Choice Band and a Damage Bench Pokemon, which either meant you needed to also another energy. You need a Rainbow on one of your bench Pokemon. Or you need to play a Team Magma base and then bench something. Like, it's like a 5 or 6 card combo to get a one shot instead of like, oh, once you have 2 Archeops out, just a quick ball and you know, and the world's your oyster. Like, yeah, it's definitely a very different and slower format.
So this wasn't one of our topics, but do you have hope that the game's going to get back to that heyday? Are these reveals of Scarlet Violet making you think, yeah, this is possible to get back there, or are we kind of in this accelerated format forever?
I mean, I think it's very telling that even after Scarlet Violet came out and you have like this Gardevoir EX, that the dominating decks in Japan are still the single prize Lost Box plus the Lugia Tyranitar. Stonejourner, like, people are finding new ways to play Lugia. Mm-hmm. And also like the Mew EX. So it's very telling that, you know, Gardevoir is like a very good card, but even that is struggling to compete against some of the current meta decks. So I do think there's a bit of a reset, like looking at some of the, like, the what is it, Great Tusk, and like some of the fighting support. Mm-hmm. Looking at Miraidon and like some of that electric support, there's definitely like a slowdown in the game. I do love the fact that there's the new the new 2 prizers, like the EXs, have to evolve from non-EXs. One of the main problems, I think, with some recent metagames was that V-Stars and V-Maxes evolving from Vs is that those Vs were often bench sitters. And, like, if you remember, like, the Arceus Wars of maybe last year, where it's like, if you went first, like, okay, well, the ultimate goal is, if your opponent only has 1 bench Arceus V, is to then get the V-Star for the DTE choice. What is it? It's a band, a belt now. Choice belt,
Zigzagoon.
Zigzagoon, right? And then get the 220 knockout, and then you win the game. Like, that will no longer be the case as much, because, like, And the problem is, like, okay, like, you bench, like, even in Lugia Wars right now, if you go second and you think your opponent has a great chance to get a Lugia V star, you have to bench two Lugia Vs because a boss play, you know, with decks playing two Lumineon now, like, a boss play, just, you're dead if you only have one Lugia V. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, if that Lugia V dies, you just give up two prizes straight up. You just lost a third of the, you just, like, you're just a third of the way there. And with no comeback mechanic, no true comeback mechanic, I guess Roxanne is a comeback mechanic, but Roxanne's, like, not that great because it's a dead card for the first, you know, it's not consistency.
Yeah.
Like, Edna adds consistency to your deck early game. Roxanne is just a dead card for half the game. You know, like, you can't even take advantage of the fact that you just gave up two prizes because you lost a coin flip and your opponent drew a little better. So it's very different than if, like, for example, like, the Ralts are basics. So, like, you can choose to either, you know, even if you hit a Ralt and kill it, you know, you're giving up one prize instead of two. And I think that's a important but often neglected part of why, you know, the VMAX formats were so fast and maybe people felt like they weren't as good as previous formats.
I think that was really well said. For we have a fair amount of listeners who were did not play pre-V, or at least didn't play very much pre-V, of, like, why the GX and the Sun and Moon era, pre-tag team even, was considered so, you know, beloved, right?
Yeah, even the first couple tag teams weren't, oh, sorry, even, just quick note, even, like, the first couple tag teams people didn't regard as, like, too toxic. So, for example, like, Pikarom had, like, a one-card counter in Buzzwall, and yes, it needed to be a four prizes left in a specific situation, but, like,
you could force
it
that.
Was still possible to counter. You can, yeah, you can sort of build a deck, like, Zap Beast was such a good deck because you could force that situation, and you have one turn to knock out that Pikarom. So Pikarom players started not putting the Pikarom down until they had four prizes left, or until they were past that threshold, so they would attack with Zapdoses and whatnot, and sacrifice Jirachis until you got... So it's like, there was still, like, some sort of skill expression there, but I think the newer tag teams just got too much HP and got a little too degenerate, and then sort of format went downhill from there.
That was completely unnecessary aside, but it's my podcast. One of the, like, vivid memories I have of an opponent's reaction, it was game one of Denver Regionals. I was playing Pikarom, but I was playing Gustavo Wada's build with the Jolteon and, like, three Zapdos. And I was playing it like a Zapdos deck, and I used Jolteon's GX attack into the Sledgehammer turn, so Jolteon can't be damaged. And they're like, okay, right, you know, whatever. They go KO a Jirachi off the bench or something. And then I go Pikarom, Coco Prism, Thunder Mountain Attach, Full Blitz. And just the like, the what? Like, excuse me? You're Pikarom the whole time? It was beautiful. It made me so happy to just see that reaction.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, that's why the first tag teams were not so unbalanced, because, like, you were afraid to bench it.
Mm-hmm.
In certain matches.
Oh, yeah.
Like, right? You can't just bench it with impunity and say, well, you know, I'm going to start attaching and you're going to lose. Like, there was still some skill around, hey, I'm not going to bench this Pikarom or else I'm going to lose the game if I bench it. That no longer existed after a while with the announcers. Yeah. Especially when they removed ADP's weakness through a clever errata by just eliminating the fairy type altogether.
That was, you know, that was good card design right there.
Good card design, yeah.
And then, as a quick, you also mentioned Ninetales Reshiram as the actual... No, Ninetales...
Typhlosion Ninetales.
Typhlosion Ninetales.
Yeah.
Okay, this one, yeah, I actually have no idea.
I actually have the deck with me.
have you just never unsleeved it, or do you rebuild it?
No, this is one of the decks I just have on my desk because it's so, like... It's these cards. I guess this is the Kolava. It's these two cards.
Oh, this is Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah.
That's so not what I was expecting.
So I actually won my very first major event, which was a Super Battle Zone in 2003 with this deck, and I have it sleeved right here. I actually couldn't
same cards.
This wasn't like a show and tell. Oh, these are the same cards, the exact cards.
Oh, that's so good.
With the best card ever printed. Yeah. These were, like... so it was the Neo Genesis Typhlosion with the Legendary Collection Ninetales, which is a reprint of the base set Ninetales.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it's actually super cool that in 2003, Power Creep wasn't that bad, that a card from 4 years ago from the base set was still, like, a very viable card to play in a deck.
That is there was a lot of bad card design in that era, but it is interesting how the Pokemon in general didn't get significantly better or worse through Rocket and Gym and then even Neo up until, you know, Slowking and Sneasel, I guess, if you want to count them. If you want to count the wrong Slowking, right? Like, everything was kind of the same. Same HP, hit the same damage. It was a very interesting. The trainers, on the other hand, let's not talk about those.
Well, the trainers, they actually realized the huge mistakes they were making. So, like, from Neo Genesis, they printed Professor Elm, which is shuffle your hand in your deck, draw 7, but no more trainers for the rest of the turn. Mm-hmm. And they also printed, like, Double Gust, which is just the worst gust of wind, because your opponent got to do this. So people had to build their decks around, like, playing Double Gust.
Yeah.
So they sort of realized that. And in the Ruby and Sapphire block, they printed Energy Removal 2.
Crushing Hammer.
Just Energy Removal in a card. And like Pokemon Reversal, which is Gust of Wind on a coin flip. So they realized that, oh man, we had some pretty broken cards in the first set of the game, and they sort of corrected that. And so yeah, I mean, it's a pretty beloved format, I guess, as well, because of the nostalgic reasons, and also, as you said, Pokemon were sort of balanced, with the exception of Slowking, which is a whole other story. And the Fralligator, they didn't test very well.
Well, that's true. Anyway, let's jump into... We've been talking for over 25 minutes. I'm sure we can keep talking about old format stuff. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about other history stuff for sure. But
sure, yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about organized play stuff. And the reason that I asked you, and I think I told you this beforehand, but the reason I asked you is when I first started playing, I remember you went on a seemingly a mission. I don't know where, like, it was a chicken egg thing where you decided to prove that the system was so broken that you were just going to fly to SPEs, which are regionals without prize money, and very often had attendances of like 60 or less people. Some are a little larger, but they gave regional level CP just to prove that you could day two just by doing like these things to prove how broken the system was. And so when I thought about like, who can we have on to talk about how broken the system is, Sam is the perfect person. So I don't know if you want to start with that, or if you want to start with a little bit about the organized play part, but why is the system what it is?
Yeah, so first on the system and then on the why. Okay. So this is 2018 when they started shadow dropping SPEs, meaning that they would like not make it publicly announced. Like, I didn't find out about there was an SPE in Bogota, Colombia, like the South American country, Colombia, that I just did not know about. I mean, like, you have to be scouring the tournament listings to even see, or maybe following or having friends in the area. Mm-hmm. And so I was like pretty upset. And, but at the point I was already like locked in top 16 when this was happening. So this is when I was, I guess, better as a player. So, I was already locked in top 16 at that point. So I was like, okay, you know what? This is a really, really stupid system. And so my response was then to, because no one was really doing it until a few people started doing it. And I don't blame these people for traveling to these events at all, because, you know, like, it's available, right? These are the rules of the game. The rules may not be very fair to poorer people, but at the same, or people who, you know, have jobs that they can't just leave, but, you know, that's
what the rules are. It's what we signed up for, technically.
And so I booked a last minute trip to Jakarta, and it was a very expensive trip. The only way I was going to make any money back on this trip was if I won the event. So I had a 32 hour flight from Los Angeles to Seoul, to Singapore, to Jakarta, mm-hmm. booked a hotel last minute and went to play at Jakarta Regionals, won the event, and then flew back. And then the week after, I was in Sao Paulo for an IC. And then I was like, screw this. I'm just going to, you know, demonstrate how broken this system is, because, like, you know, the relatively richer American players, and some American players like, oh, well, they're not that rich. Okay, like, just as a country, America is one of the richest countries in the world. Mm-hmm. So, like, players from this country can then fly to you know, events that are designed for locals to get CP is because they realized, hey, like there aren't enough regionals in these regions. We want to make sure locals have a chance to play and have a chance to get CPs, to get their world's invite. And we have like these Americans flying in to farm them. And so I went then that later that year to Mexico City SPE, which is actually a quite difficult event. A lot of good players were there, like Zach Lesage, Danny Altavilla, Rahul Reddy, Jose Marrero.
That's one that others. Screams to me not hard to get to. Like, I assume, right?
Like, no, it was not hard to get to. But still, it's like a, you know, if you think about it, it's like still a cost, right? Like, think
oh, for
of
sure.
How much money.
Path like, it's for. Even if, yeah.
Yeah, the path for international flight, like, you know, even if it's a couple hundred dollars, these pile up. And, like, it's not really fair to have, like, a top 16 chase when certain people can. And other people, you know, to get to that Mexico City SPE, you know, you probably have to take Thursday, Friday off work. Let's just say at the bare minimum. And so like you have to not only work a job where you have that flexibility, but also then have the money to say that spending, you know, $500 on a trip to a tournament where I don't get any cash prizing is worth it for me to do this one thing. And so then it was actually a pretty tough event. I guess it wasn't. The chances of winning were much higher than a regional, but like in terms of the quality of player, it was certainly not that bad. And then I went the week after the Cancun SPE.
That just sounds great.
More there. Oh, that it was great. This was prior to the alcohol policy of Pokemon. At some point,
yeah.
And there was an open bar outside the venue, and like literally the venue's door was here, and then like around the corner was a bar. And it was an all-you-can-drink one-day pass. And so we thought, why not? Go for it.
Like, how could this be a bad thing?
$60 is fine. It wasn't $60. It was $15. Bottomless, like, pina coladas and margaritas for the whole day. And so between every round, we would just go get a drink if we finished early. This was obviously all before Pokemon's alcohol policy.
Yeah.
I tweeted at that point, like, what is the official Pokemon policy on blood alcohol level at events? Asking for a friend.
Yeah. So you're the reason that they added.
No, I'm actually not the reason. There was an underage incident a few years later.
Oh,
that was the
impetus
for this. As an adult at that time, I was responsible with drinking and not causing a scene at the venue. Yeah.
Good choice. Always drink responsibly.
Yeah. Yeah, when you're 26 or 27, you have better sense of what's responsible drinking compared to when you're like, let's just say this child was 16 or 17.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
All right. So you were able to travel all these SPEs, right?
Yeah.
Were there any others? Like, this is already so much travel. Like listening to this, even like pre, you know, kid me is like, that's a lot. Like, I've got a full-time job. I can't imagine getting off. I literally can't get that much time off. The teacher is like, hey, you have spring break and that's it, right? Which is like, cool. I'm super grateful for summer break and spring break, but you don't get to choose those days. They choose them for you. So like, how is this actually working?
Yeah, so I'm fortunate enough to work a job where I'm remote. I was even remote before COVID. Mm-hmm. So I work at a consulting company building financial models for banks and other types of consulting work. And so I can always work remote, and I have the type of work ethic where I'm willing to like put in 18-hour days for like 3 or 4 days straight just to get something done. Mm-hmm. Like I'm willing to just like sit there. Like I was always that way in school, like studying too. Like people like... I don't focus very well. And so like, I have to have like some sort of goal in my head to be able to sit there and focus. As I got older, I like trained myself to be able to put my head to a task and get it done, especially if like the goal is, oh, I get to go to this trip to play this SP. So actually that was a period where I went to seven tournaments, all regional level and above in terms of CP payout. Mm-hmm. In 7 weeks.
It was oh like, my gosh.
Yeah. I don't know like the exact order of, I forget the exact order, but yeah. it was Jakarta, Mexico, Cancun, Toronto, Madison, Sao Paulo. And I'm missing one somewhere from that list.
Yeah. But that's,
it'll come to me. But yeah, so like I'm able to work on airplanes, sleep on airplanes pretty well. Yeah, just so you just if that's something you want to do. I mean, it's not for everyone, and it's certainly nothing I would recommend or even do again at this point. But for the degenerates, I mean, I really just wanted to prove that it could be done to buy a day two invite, and that's not very competitively fair. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very against, they've designed a tournament system that's like very against the very spirit of the game that they purport to uphold.
So I want to play devil's advocate to the buy it real quick, because this is not a fun podcast if I just co-sign everything.
No, please. I'm more than happy to take criticism of this opinion.
So you still, like, you can go to 7 regionals in 7 weeks, or the IC in there, whatever, who cares, right? 7 regionals in 7 weeks. That doesn't mean you're going to perform at those regionals without good finishes. So where does that line get drawn between the day two invite of, I'm just going to throw a bunch at the wall and eventually stuff will stick, versus like, you still have to get high finishes, right? Like, let's look at Piper this year. At 3 regionals include a win, and a top 8, right? Like, she is just, the quality there is not something you can replicate just by going to every regional, right? So like, where does that come into play?
So that year there was no best finish limit, which was a huge problem.
Oh God.
So,
okay. There goes my argument, I guess.
Yep. So that was one of the things that was majorly wrong that year. So if you picked up a top 256 here and a top 64 there, like, those points get cumulatively added. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you go to 25 events and you get points at all of them, you get 25 finishes.
Yeah, that's
so that's bad. I guess that's the counter argument there. But the other side is, I think there is a there's a combination of things, right? One, like, North America already gets a little bit shafted on day two spots in terms of our player base. Like, we only get 16 spots in terms of like active players, and you know, it's not the correct ratio. Mm-hmm. And also there's a certain group of people that just have, like, you know, I think there should be, yes, money is always going to be a part of it, like money and time, right? This is, Pokemon is a hobby. This is not a job, not a career. As a player, it's not a career. You know, as a coach or working for the company, sure. But as a player, this is not a career. This is a fun thing, your interest, your hobby. And this is coming from, you know, I've always believed this, even at mm-hmm. when I was playing at the highest level. This is, you're not making money or supporting yourself on a tournament, from tournament winnings, plain and simple. And so there is, you know, for the fact that they've set up this system where there is this prestige to winning internationals and worlds and finishing in top 16 and having an advantage going into day two of worlds, like, the fact that they've set up this system for this thing, this carrot to chase, you know, they need to make sure that system can't just be bought by people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can't just be bought out by the 16 above average players who have the largest wallets. And I think by, you know, changing certain things, it would allow it to be more like people who, like Piper, who may not have that much opportunity to travel between school and other things she does, to go internationally. Like, she missed OCIC. She missed, I think, LAIC as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm friends with her. I haven't talked to her exactly why she missed the events, but yeah. Like, people who compete, like, it's a North American top 16, not like a Globetrotter top 16. Like, Piper, arguably, and now Andrew Hendricks are the two best North American players this season. I guess an argument can be made for Azul and you know, his myriad of top 16s with his IC win.
Yeah.
And, you know, John and another top, like, sure, internationals, yeah. Sure. But, like, it's, I definitely think that top 16 should be representative of people, of 16 of the reasonably great players from your region, not 16 players who are paying to travel to every event and then, as a result, getting an auto day two of worlds.
I think it's interesting. I want to address the, like, what you just mentioned of, like, Piper and Andrew Hendrick. I have won multiple regionals this year, multiple gigantic regionals this year. Like, even when you look at San Diego, it's like, bro, there's only like 800 something people. You know, pre-COVID, that was 800 person regional. That's gigantic, right? Like, that's something that I think they're both about in the top 16, but they're like, they're barely hanging in there. And I don't think either of them have been to any of the ICs this year. So,
yeah, I mean, I really don't know what to think about the, I mean, I do have some opinions, but I don't have like a, final conclusion on it. I do think that ICs are important to the game, but they're overweighted in terms of points.
Would a best finish, is it as simple as putting a best finish limit on it?
I don't think so. I think Pokemon wants people to go to their flagship events. So there's something to be said about that. Maybe a best finish limit could be helpful, but also I think lowering the payout to like mediocre finishes at ICs. Like I'm okay with like the, like if you win IC 500 points, like, you know, you deserve it. Good job. Like I think Azul deserves the 500 points. I'll just speak for myself. I mean, I got 200 points for top 16 or finishing ninth at OCIC, which is equivalent of an American regional win. And if you want to think about it, it's basically a BFL list, like outside the best finish limit regional win. And it's
half the size technically. And there's another debate in there of percentage of good player versus not, right? But
yeah, I mean, I think OCIs, I think the ICs, because they draw good players from every region in the world, it's I mean, it was 530-ish people, like way harder than a 530 person American regional.
Yeah.
Like just in terms of like just you hit random good players from other regions, like just randomly playing through because there's a huge concentration of top players flying in. So I'm okay with like the difficulty of the event. And it's just, you know, it's Oceania, so it's far for everyone and expensive. But I mean, like, I'll give myself an example. I bubbled out of, or I was 5-3-1 at LAIC, and I got 80 points for it, for finishing 5-3-1. 80 points is a top 16 at a US regional. Like, so just speaking to my own finishes, like, it is not, it is like quite high amount of CPs you get for, just for myself, a pretty mediocre performance at 5-3-1. So, I mean, there is something to be said about the chase and like paying for events, but I do think like SPEs are extremely bad offender of this because SPEs are generally in like hard to reach areas where like flights are expensive, especially nowadays. And also the tournaments, you know, the quality of player on average is not very competitive compared to like a US regional, just a matter of fact, right? The people who've played less, nothing against those areas. And the tournaments are much smaller. Like the Mexican SPs are probably 60 to 80 people. Some of the South American ones are 20 people. I mean, a lot of people from 2017, 2018, 2019 have gone to farm those events, myself included. And it's just like not very fair, not only to everyone else in the US, but oftentimes like they schedule SPEs with the idea that, oh, that 200 point could go to a local to help them get their world's invite, right? And to like to grow the game in a smaller country or a smaller area, you want people from the local area to make the world championships. Because like when you see someone make worlds, it sort of snowballs. You know, you see, oh, this person made worlds. I want to make worlds next year. I have talked to people who find it a little discouraging that, you know, they're basically taking worlds invites away from, like, we're taking worlds invites away from weaker regions. The intent there is not to give Americans a CP farm or in a different part of the world. The idea there is to promote local play without having to pay out for a regional. And obviously that, at least before COVID, that wasn't getting achieved by the SPs or the fact that, Americans were, going in to farm these points was not helpful toward the effect of getting more local players toward the World's Invite.
So the current like system is, and we had Henry Brand on at the start of the Lost Origin format, explaining why top four in Oceania is literally one of the worst things I could have ever done for the game, right? Because it's like more than four people work together and now you can't work with your friends because blah blah blah, right? LATAM gets 8, I believe, EU gets 22, and NA gets 16. Is that system ever going to become better if it stops being top X and starts being a CP threshold for each area? Or is it like top X is good and the rest of the system around it needs to be fixed? Or is this a like everything's just kind of messed up right now and everything needs to get fixed, like just period?
So do you know why it's 22 and 16 for Europe and America?
My assumption, and please tell me when I'm wrong, but my assumption has been because Worlds is in North America every single year and Europe has a giant player base and it's to help more players get that stipend to travel over to North American Worlds. But that's purely just me guessing.
So you are on the right track, but there is a very specific reason why it's 22 and 16. Mm-hmm. The 22 for Europe is because there used to be 11 national championships in Europe before they moved over to the international championship format. So the national championships used to pay out a travel award for first and second place to the world championships.
Okay.
And so with 11 nationals and 22 now travel awards, they didn't want to take anything away from Europe. The reason originally for those travel awards was to help them, the national champion and the second place finisher, to be able to go to Worlds in the United States. So you are correct about that part. But the reason why specifically it's 22 is just because of the 11 former national championships that existed.
How long and ago 16 was that? In North America,
up until 2015. Up until 2014, 2015 season.
Okay.
I think.
So it's been like 8 years and they're like, yeah, this is fine.
They've been like, yeah, this is fine. And it's 16 in North America, probably because it's a nice power of two. As an educational professional, you will probably understand that people choose 16 to as an arbitrary power of two and say, ah, you know, 16. But that is actually the reason why. And so, like, I've done this analysis before, and I've also done this analysis for, like, this season, just up until, you know, last week, where, like, you can look at it by various metrics, right? Like, the player base. And you can look at, like, players with any championship points, which is sort of fair because, like, you need to, this year especially, you need to go to regionals and then perform a top 256 or top 128 level to get any championship points at all. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at people with championship points in North America, there's about 1,250. In Europe, there's about 450. In LATAM, there's about 250. In Oceania, there's 90-ish people. So you can already see sort of, yeah, you can see sort of the disparity, you know, North America, 1,250, Europe, 450. That doesn't tell the full story though, right? Because you can also look at like average regional attendance. For average regional attendance in North America, it's about 1,100. Mm-hmm. For Europe, it's about 700. So you see that disparity drop a little bit. And then for LATAM, it's 250, Oceania is 182, which is fine. Or then you can look at then people who have participated in organized play at all. And so we look at people with at least one play point. So this includes like pre-releases and things like that.
It includes so league, 18, right? 000. Like official sanctioned league, yeah, gives league. A play point. Okay.
Yes, yes. So North America and has about 18,200 people with at least one play point.
Sheesh.
Europe has about 7,400. So just even the general player base, you'll see like Europe is about half the size of North America. Mm-hmm. And then LATAM has 3,800 and Oceania is 900. And then the last metric I looked at is people with three play points. And the reason why I looked at three play points is because having attended one regional championship or like you're consistently going to these local events to get play points. So with three play points, North America is about 1,400 people. Europe has about 5,400 people. LATAM has 2,600 and Oceania has about 750.
You said 1,400. So do you mean 14,000 for North America?
14,000. Okay. 14,000 cool. In North America have attended at least three play points. And so, I mean, it's great for the game, right? This is showing these are pretty big numbers even compared to historically, despite the fact that there's no local events. But if you break that down in terms of like just in terms of sheer like there's 50 auto day two spots, right? As you mentioned, there's like four plus eight plus 16 plus 22. That's 50 spots. If you were to take the most conservative metrics that allocates the most spots based on regional attendance, so it's allocating more spots to lesser populated areas or lesser overall areas where people overall play, that would be for the 50 spots, it would be 24 to North America, 16 to Europe, 8 to LATAM, and 4 to Oceania. And this is based on average regional attendance. if you just look at the average regional attendance in those four territories.
Did you now, keep those numbers pretty say, on okay, purpose?
No, that's okay. Exact.
Okay. Like,
yeah, these numbers actually get a lot uglier if you look at like from a different angle. Mm-hmm. So this is based on just average regional attendance, which is like sort of the, and you can say there's small sample size. Oceania only had a few regionals. LATAM only had one, I think, so far. So yeah, it's not, you know, the greatest, you know, there is some small sample size issues, but you see overall, like the ratio is like 24 North America, 16 Europe, six LATAM, four Oceania. If you look at sort of the worst of the metrics, which is people with three play points or the least conservative in terms of handing spots out, three play points or people with CP, that would be 31 in North America, 11 to Europe, 6 to LATAM, and 2 to Oceania. So we can see by like tournament attendance, and obviously tournament attendance is a function of availability and mm-hmm. the fact that there's so many in America. But like in that range, right? Like if you want to do it sort of, and there's other metrics that I thought of just to keep it simple for, you know, the listeners, somewhere between 24 and 31 spots out of the 50 for North America and 11 to 16 spots for Europe. And if we can even reduce that by a little bit to give more spots to Oceania to encourage people to play, I'm okay with that as well. Mm-hmm. And LATAM, the more developing zones. But I think, yeah, the fact that 22 spots goes to Europe, 16 goes to North America, it's like pretty archaic and it's sort of entrenched and no one has, I guess it needs to be recalibrated at some point. And will it ever change? Not hopeful in the future. Because of, you know, some of the organized play issues that we spoke of before. Yeah.
Do you think, like, is this ever something that they're worried about, the day two structure? Or is it, and this is something most of our listeners are like, bro, day two is a pipe dream, right? I've been invite and chill my whole time playing. Like, day two isn't even I've been in technically contention for an IC stipend twice, and both times I've been like, no, I'm not even going to another regional to do it, let alone anything else. So is day two something that they're even looking at, or are they worried about that day one number and then day two is like, meh, whatever, day one will fix the day two stuff by the time it rolls around?
They will never care about the day two number. I think the current people at organized play have shown that they do not give a damn about competitive fairness in day two. It's just like something that it's like a shiny carrot they can hold out mm-hmm. and like just it's a dogfight for it and no one cares. Like, I don't think anyone, I guess it's unfair to say that people don't care. I think that anyone who works for Pokemon who cares are not the ones making the decisions about the tournament format.
Yeah.
And regarding day one too, I mean, look how long it took them to give us any information. I mean, they knew well in advance that locals weren't coming back. I know for a fact that they knew mm-hmm. that was the case. And they decided to not announce anything as January rolled around. Like, people anticipating, especially people with, you know, who are banking the world's invites on going to a lot of local events and filling them out in January. I know people who are locals of mine in California now who have told me, like, yeah, they're just going to wait until January when locals come around. So they're going to go to a few regionals. And because it's so like prohibitively expensive to go to East Coast regionals.
Oh yeah.
Like the most egregious, my Baltimore flight was 500 something. My flight to Peoria, just the flight, wasn't even a direct flight because Peoria is the wilderness, you know.
It's just not Chicago. Why is it not Chicago?
Because the tournament organizer wants to save money.
I mean,
Peoria actually has an even funnier story, or even sadder story, depending on how you want to view it. But my Peoria flight was $700, just the flight, not hotel, not, you know, food or any kind. Yeah, just $700. Okay.
Oh, that's outside of my budget. For any listeners wondering, that is, yeah. I set a budget of $400 is the maximal for a flight, which is not easy from the West Coast.
Yeah, this is a complete digression, but Peoria was supposed to be in St. Louis, but some logistical issues and incompetence overall led to it being employed. That's all I'll say about
tremendous.
It. Tremendous. Tremendous, yeah. But back to this point is like some of my locals were like, hey, we're going to go to the West Coast regionals in Dallas, right? There's five. There's Vancouver, Fresno, Dallas, Salt Lake, and I'm missing one, San Diego. So we're just going to go to those and we're going to fill in the 500 points with locals. And the problem is then like you announced this halfway through, if they knew in September that they weren't going to even like in there were some cheaper regionals you could have gone to on the East Coast had they known they needed 350. So one of my friends who lives like 10 minutes away from me is like now literally going out to every regional and going to Knox. He went to Knoxville. He's going to like Charlotte and Fort Wayne, like just to chase his invite because it wasn't told to us earlier before that, oh, you need to get 350 points through just regionals and ICs. And it's a little like, honestly, it's a little hostile to players, especially if they don't live in a geographically advantageous area to play Pokemon, like the Midwest or living by a hub, an airport hub in on the East Coast. And no, so like as much as they do emphasize day one, they also like this extremely poor planning of not being upfront about who makes worlds and how to make worlds is like really unfortunate. Yeah.
That announcement is such a like, because exactly what you're saying is just like something that I want to like extra cosign, because I think a lot of people out there will resonate with that as well of, okay, 500 is the goal. That means locals are coming back. If you know at the beginning of the year, it's 350 without locals, that might change. I'm not going to go to more regionals, or maybe I am going to extend out. And like I said, my budget would be 400 maximal for a round trip. Maybe I would extend out to 500, or maybe I'd say, screw that. I'm going to go down to 300 because I'm just going to go to the ones that are the best. Right. So it's so unfortunate that it took them so long for something that it seems obvious.
The worst part is like people, sure, your average player isn't going to win 8 League Cups throughout a year. Right. But I think like for an average player, 3 League Cup wins and a few points here and there, like it's very reasonable for someone to get 250 to 300 points through League Cups, especially someone who grinds locals. And people expected with locals being back, there would also be, you know, league challenges. So you can get another 50 points from league challenges, you know, assuming you don't win them all, but just random top fours and, you know, top eights and whatnot. So people can reasonably expect to get 300 points from locals. And so there was people who were banking on doing that and grinding that. And so for them, the plan at the original of the year, like I actually worked with someone on this. It's like, how many points do I need to expect to get from regionals? And the answer is like, if you can get around 200 points from regionals, then you can, if you're willing to go every weekend to locals when they come back, you're gonna grind and get there. And like the fact that they reduced it by 150, like it's really a slap in the face to a lot of fans who have been waiting for this to come back and yeah.
What do you think?
But you know, it's what we have to live with and yeah.
What do you think was the point of the 150? This is purely speculation now, right? But like they lowered it by 150 and like you said, the 200 is about the number I would have expected, right? I'm thinking of myself in the first year that I competed, I earned 220 or something like that from regionals. And then I got my invite the previous year, the pre-COVID one off of what? 80 plus 60, whatever that is, 140 and the rest from locals. So like, it was like 200, sure, whatever, right? That's about correct. But like, why would they lower it by 150? Why is this just a random number that they picked out? Did they actually look at the data, do you think? Or like, have you tried looking at the data and being like, yeah, this is logically what makes sense? Or did they throw a random number at a wall?
My suspicion is that they threw a random number at the wall. I think when it comes to TPCI and these decisions, you just have to assume there's no actual, like, they've already used both of their brain cells to even announce that there were no locals. So then to then set a threshold for a reasonable threshold for people to get their world's invite is not something that I, and this is all speculation, but I don't think that they did it. I mean, I think it's, they took in 2016, I believe that was the year they lowered the invite to 350 or something. And it's like, oh, just lower it again. Same number. I mean, it's possible that someone had a spreadsheet and spent 5 minutes on it as well. So who knows?
I mean, is a 5 minute spreadsheet really better than throwing a number at a wall?
I mean, what they really should have done is like mapped out, like what level of finishes do we think someone should have to get worlds, you know? like maybe to be a world's caliber player, maybe like one top eight at regionals, one top 16, and then, you know, four top 64 finishes throughout the year. Maybe that's someone who's qualified enough for worlds. So that would be, you know, 100 plus 80 plus 200. So maybe they said, okay, that's 380 down to 350. Maybe they did some back of the napkin math there.
Yeah.
But obviously it's extremely difficult to top eight a regional nowadays, especially
like only eight people do it. People top eight.
Yeah. Only eight people do it. And there aren't that many people a year that do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this comes to another point we were sort of talking about before we got on the started recording, which is about like, you know, organized play being marketing function and not necessarily a organized play function. Yeah.
What do you mean by a marketing function?
Yeah, so organized play, for those who don't know, sits under the marketing division of TPCI. Like, there's no like, it's not like oh, like this is, you know, we want to. It's not like sort of Magic the Gathering where their whole product is based on the fact that tournaments exist. Right. And there is that to some extent in Pokemon. But like Magic started off as a card game. So if there's no tournaments, the game, at least back in the day, the game would just die. Pokemon as a franchise, the card game is sort of auxiliary to the overall media franchise. And so the goal, the overarching goal of Play Pokemon and the organized play is to make money for Pokemon. It's marketing. And we are in a weird spot right now, right? Like, some people complain about pricing, which I think is valid. Some people complain about why is there no communication and transparency. We have to understand that, like, TBCI and Pokemon in general is already getting the marketing benefit of having run events. You know, there are these regional streams. There are, there's these, like, worlds and IC streams that, you know, Pokemon is getting talked about still in the YouTube culture, I guess, in the general, you know, in the general gaming zeitgeist. Pokemon is considered one of the three OG card games with Magic and Yu-Gi-Oh. So, like, you know, for they are getting that benefit, that marketing benefit of staying relevant, of getting talked about, and also just having those media clips to be able to, you know, market the game. And so, you know, I also do think there is some benefit to Pokemon for, like, there being something to do with these cards. Like, if there was no organized play, people were just collecting it, I think the game would not sell as well. And I know for a fact, and this is something that people may not be aware, but like 90% of Pokemon TCG sales are like little kids going to buy, you know, EX boxes at their local big box store. It is not the competitive player. And so they need to balance, you know, they need to balance the fact that the game really, they're not making that much money off the competitive scene in terms of like competitive players buying cards. They're making money by marketing the idea that there is this Pokemon trading card game that you can play with your friends. That is where they're getting the marketing benefit. And so, like, the way I think of tournaments is sort of, the way I believe TPCI thinks of organized play in tournaments is sort of the concept of, like, in business, there's like the idea of a loss leader. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Well, let's pretend I'm not. What is
basically
it?
Yeah, so it's like, for it's basically like a product that you sell or something, a cost that you take to attract customers. And so a good example is like Costco sells like their hot dogs for like basically like less than a dollar, right? You get like a slice of pizza for $2.
Yeah.
The rotisserie chickens are all, so Costco's rotisserie chickens are $4.99 across the country, no matter what, regardless of inflation. And the reason for that is they put the rotisserie chicken back in the kitchen. So if you're going to go get that $5 rotisserie chicken, you're going to walk through the whole store and then you're going to pick up some of the things you need.
It's a big old store.
Like,
yeah.
I am guilty of going to like, hey, what do I want for lunch? Let's just go to the Costco food court, get like some cheap hot dogs and pizza, and then we'll go like do our Costco run. So like, that's the idea of a loss leader, right? Like, they're not making money on those chickens. They're not making money on the hot dogs and chicken wraps or whatever, I forgot what they were called, but the chicken bakes, like, they're not making money on that. They're there as an incentive for then for you to go to the store to buy their other stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that, like, organized play, the marketing, the streams are for people, like casual people, to see on YouTube, oh, Pokemon, there's this tournament, I want to go buy some cards. And that's something they've learned like pretty recently. Like they've only recently been less hostile towards like content creators and allowing them to use their trademarks and images, in a way that's, that helps promote the game. Like they've only recently started recognizing, and this is like in the last 5 years, started recognizing the benefit of popular YouTubers and streamers on how like pack openings and things like that, how that contributes to their audience and like the overall marketing of Pokemon.
And can I add to that real quick as the content creator side of it to kind of co-sign what you're saying? I'm a big fan. The person who is in charge of the content creation outreach for Pokemon TPCI is incredibly good at his job and probably doesn't get paid enough for how good he is at communicating for a corporation that's bad at communication. But the way they support competitive content creators is, I love it, please keep doing it, but they send us product to open up on stream, right? It's not anything competitive related. I don't know if they know how that would be done, even if they want to, but it doesn't seem like they want to. And I'm a big fan. I will happily open up on stream and for YouTube any and all product they give me because it's incredibly fun to do. But that's how they support us, right? Is, hey, competitive content creator, Mellow Magikarp or Azul or whomever, open the product, which is going towards pack openings, selling product, not the competitive game, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is really all they can do because, I mean, if you just look at like views of like and popularity of people who do pack openings versus like competitive streamers, like
it's massive.
Only a few, like it's massive difference because people, the general population is wants to go to Target and pick up a pack and open a shiny, EX card or V card.
Yeah.
They don't want to sit down and learn the game. And so to that end, like there is some, like the whole point of organized play, I think from a marketing's perspective is that there's this appeal for someone to like be like, hey, I want to compete in tournament. I want to go to local pre-release. Like I want there, like this is just something else to do with the cards, or else it's just like collecting baseball cards, and Pokemon would not be as, would not be as pop. I mean, baseball collections are obviously can get very pricey, and but there's it's not as mainstream and culturally mainstream as Pokemon is. And I think part of the contributing factor is not only that it's the Pokemon media franchise, but that there is a card game associated with the tournament structure and card game associated with it.
Is this why you think pre-releases are the only local to have come back outside of, I guess, League, I guess, but like, is this why pre-releases were rushed back and challenges and cups are like, eventually maybe.
Yes. So if you view the entire working of organized play as a function of marketing, and also keeping in mind that the team of people who run organized play are severely underpaid, which I also, I guess, I mean, they're basically making, entry level position salaries in terms of field, like where they could get a job elsewhere. Like it is not, I mean, I don't blame them at all. Like they're not given the resources, they're not paid enough. And then their directive is to sell cards, not to foster a vibrant, competitive and healthy tournament structure.
And that's something that I think is anyone who's looked for jobs at TPCI has noticed as a whole, they underpay and they underpay because they can, right? Like I have friends who work at TPCI and, I met them before they did that. And they're like, I'm going to take a pay cut because I want to work for Pokemon. Or we had a few episodes on to talk about TCG Live, Zach Roy, Senior Doom, incredibly talented artist, can make a ton of money for Amazon and stuff, but he wants to work for Pokemon. He's like, I'm going to take a massive pay cut if they ever actually call me back. Pokemon, please call him back. He's quite good. But it's, you also kind of fall into a rut of you get what you pay for, even if people want to work for Pokemon.
I mean, yes, I like many other players have once ventured down the dark alley of the career page of the Pokemon website. And I mean, if you just look on like other sites like Glassdoor where you compare wages, like they do not necessarily at certain levels pay competitive wages.
I don't want you to incriminate yourself if you want a job there. So
No, I know that I am not seeking that. If I do take a job there, you won't know that they have adjusted their compensation
to competitive wages.
2023. Yeah. yeah. Competitive wages. Oh, I mean, it's a combination of many things. And I think as players, like there's some things we can do and there's some things we can't do. Mm-hmm. But anything we propose as players, it cannot cost more money. And two, like, you have to work around the bureaucracy, and oftentimes that's like extremely difficult, and few have tried. Almost all have failed. It's mm-hmm. just, yeah, it's not a great feeling, especially as a longtime competitive player. But I think for me, I'm like very zen about the shortcomings of organized play, and just understand that, you know, we get what we get, and I'm. It's been described to me by someone that, you know, who works for organized play, that it's mostly just a labor of love, right? Mm-hmm. It's not Pokemon isn't expecting, you know, wild profits from this. They could get profits from this if they would ever cross promote with other companies, but Pokemon itself, the Japanese parent company, is extremely conservative when it comes to their brand. And you would be, right? If you're the number one media franchise in the world, by gross revenue. For multiple years now, you would be defensive of your IP, and you know, you don't want to affiliate with a brand and that brand is now known for using child labor for something, and like, so you just don't want to take on that particular, and then it, you know, gets tied to you because your shirts are now being made of whatever, with child labor, or like you're associating with a brand who is doing something that's unethical. And Pokemon, you know, has tried to be, you know, Pokemon donates, this is something great they do. They donate to causes, you know, I know they donated like $200,000 to BLM. They donated some amount to Turkey, I believe, for the recent earthquake.
Yeah, they're very recently.
Am I wrong on that?
Nope, you're correct.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but at the same time, you know, even like it took until 2019 to allow like white people to play organized events in Korea. And yeah. Even this year.
It was literally like last like, week, right? Year, for Taiwan.
Last week was the Singapore issue. The Japanese player in Singapore who complained because Taiwan only let people with a Taiwanese passport compete in their event. So like any foreign local was just, you know, shafted.
I have a former student of mine who plays the game, studies abroad in Taiwan. And that was one of the things that it was like, oh, you can play while you're there. And he's like, actually, I can't. So that was
changed it.
Yeah, it was really recently. It. Yeah.
Pokemon is like, as a company, is very conservative with my point in bringing up this dichotomy is like the time they're very conservative with how their brand is. They really care about their image and they want to, you know, do good in the world. So they don't want to like cross promote with like Monster or like Red Bull or, you know, some other company to like, dude, if you put a Red Bull can on the Pokemon streams, I'm sure there's some amount of money Pokemon can make for that.
Oh, for sure.
Pokemon would never like jump in full into the esports scene like some of other competitive games do. But at the same time, you know, there's that other side, the bureaucratic side, where there's still some very interesting decisions being made at the micro level in terms of organized play, because that general philosophy doesn't necessarily permeate all the way down. So this is why we get decisions that for 20 years, white people in Korea could not play organized play. Like,
yeah,
there's one specific person that made a whole, you know, a big deal about it because he's a Pokemon fan that moved to Korea, and it's just like, I mean, yeah. So it's a mixed bag you get from Pokemon, and just organized play is often neglected.
So I had on the outline a very simple question of, will organized play improve? And I feel like I know where this is going to go, but a very simple: should we be holding our breath for a stronger system, better communication, or have we got what we're gonna get and we just need to play the game or not? I guess I'm gonna co-sign play the game because the game's fun, but
yeah, definitely play the game. But I don't think things are gonna improve in the near term. I really don't. I think it's been this way. I mean, there were drastic improvements after Nintendo first took over the franchise again in 2003, 2004. And there were some drastic improvements made around 2016, 2017 regarding prizing and also international championships and caring more about the circuit. I think it will be at some other point, there will need to be a concerted effort by internally for for things to change drastically, like a redesign of the system. They won't. I just don't think they have the capacity to make media, like to make intermediate or what's the word I'm looking for? Incremental changes mm-hmm. to the system. Like it's, I just don't think. I mean, there's no. What's amazing to me is that there's no active way to solicit feedback, not even from top players, but from general players. Like it's so hard. I've talked with PokéParents who like wanted to have feedback to Pokemon. I mean, it was only it was the year 2018, I believe, when everyone received an email who had filed a support ticket half a year later that all support tickets were being closed and that they assume that the issue has already been resolved. And if it's not been resolved, please write that.
Cool.
So that was 5 years ago. I mean, they've gotten much better at answering support tickets, but it's still like incredibly difficult to have your opinion heard. I have like personally, because I guess I care, I have lobbied like for various things. Like one of the things that I had lobbied for that I'm glad was successful is changing the stipend to be quarterly instead of annual. I was one of the main beneficiaries of like before, right? Like if you top forward Q1, then you would top four Q2 or like top 16 Q2, Q3, Q4 because the points carry over and it sort of snowballs. So if you don't do all Q1, there's just no way to compete for, you know, any of the monetary awards. And now I talked to a few people who worked at TBCI and that took still a little bit to get changed, but you know, it was something within the realm of the software that they could do. And I did gather some support from other top players who are saying like, hey, you know, we want to have the option for someone to play really hard for one quarter and to be able to get a stipend, like more diversify who gets the stipends and travel awards. Right? This is what I mean, right? Whenever you have a suggestion, it can't cost them more money. You just need to pay different people. Like that's sort of the idea. And I think like that's more fair, but those are the types of like small changes you could make. You know, if you talk to the right people or just, you know, if you know it's something that's popular and get the support from the right people. There's other like rules changes that could potentially be made. Like I was a big person who lobbied for the DPL and QPL instead of taking two prize cards. And that got changed after some time. And, you know, I talked to some people about that too. And so like there are small changes that can be made, but I would not hold my breath for like increased prize support or even better communication. I think it just heavily depends on whoever the person running the show is. Like, I know here, I'll say this, and I don't mean, and again, I've also said that these people are extremely underpaid and probably overqualified for their job. But like, if I was this bad at like communicating with my client base about tournaments and like locals, like world's invite structure, like, if I was as bad, I would be fired immediately.
I'm sick. Like,
yeah, it would just not, like, it's not a, yeah, my manager would not stand for this. Like, and I think many people who are listeners or parents here or just adult players will like, yeah, you cannot, this is not something that's tolerable in a professional setting. But again, not a professional setting. This is marketing. Yeah. This is something to consider, right? And like something wild is that like I've booked my flight to UIC very recently.
Even though registration is still not up.
Oh, registration's not up yet. I have a trip. I'm going on a trip to Taiwan probably by the time this is released or maybe a little bit after to take my wedding photos.
Cool.
I'm like deathly concerned that like they're going to drop it like when I'm taking my wedding photos or like on one of the flights. So I've actually like set up some contingencies to prevent that from happening.
Yeah.
So like I'm like set up a different Gmail account to link my Arcanine Labs account to that new Gmail account so that when it drops, I can give the password to that account to one of my friends to sign me up immediately. Like you should not be jumping through this many, like communication should not be this bad.
Yeah.
They know when the tournament is. They know the dimensions of the venue. Like, if they need help, like I can go to IKEA and buy them 100 chairs. Like I don't like like this is it's a logistical like it is so It is such a level of like incompetence and logistical failure that they don't know exactly how many people are going to be there and haven't released registration yet. And I mean, they're going to get away with it, right? Because people keep playing. And once again, as I said before, they're getting the marketing benefit. Like the average layman does not know about the struggles of like signing up for tournaments or like for LAIC last year, there were multiple waves, you know, released at 9 a.m., 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. And like, there were Pokemons like on Facebook, like, oh, I really want my son to get into this event, but I had to work a shift and then I missed it. There was only a 10-second window. I mean, it's honestly ridiculous that, you know, that their flagship events of the year have this poor communication, this poor planning. And I mean, it's really a slap in the face of the players, but you know, we love the game, we love the community, and we want to keep it growing.
Something that I guess I should have said at the start, and you made me kind of realize through that, is all these things are said, if there are any TPCI people listening, they are said out of love, but also out of, like you said, frustration. It's like, we care a lot, and that's why we are so harsh about these things. This isn't like random, like, oh, let's just bash the company, because no, this is very important to a lot of people. This is not just like, nothing Sam is saying is exclusive to you, right? Like, you represent technically, unofficially, a large amount of the player base, right? So this is just like the frustrations of many people being voiced out there, right?
Yeah. And I've talked to TBCI employees who agree with me on a lot of these things. It's just that, you know, as at a certain level, you don't have any capacity to make any change, right?
Yep.
And I fully appreciate that. There's a few people who could make changes in the position.
I hope they're listening.
I hope they're listening as well. I mean, this is, there are a lot of things they're doing right. Right. I think is something to be said as well. I mean, regionals attendance is growing. The stream is very professional. Like the tournaments start after switching to Arcanine Labs, tournaments have been running a lot smoother. Imagine having a 1,800 or 1,400 person tournament where you have to look at paper standings, which was the case up until I want to say like 2017 is when we, maybe 2018, the last time we had to look at paper standings at a regional.
San Diego 2019, when they tried to do their own program instead of RK9. I don't know if you were there, but their own custom program didn't work, and we had to do paper pairings for the last few rounds. It was bad.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
Interesting. And terrible.
interesting. Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. It's great. It helps. It contributes to the Pokemon experience. No, but I mean, I think in general, a lot of players do love the game, and like, this is a lot of frustration, but there's a lot of things being done right. Like, I think, like for the regionals IC split, that was much needed, right? Like getting rid of states, the state system was terrible. I lived in the Northeast, so I benefited tremendously from the fact that there's, you know, 10 reasonable state championships within driving distance that I could go to. Whereas on the West Coast, it's California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, sometimes Idaho had one, I guess.
and that's a state.
Yeah. But like you would have to, you know, drive for such a long distance. So like there are some imbalances that are being corrected by the globalization of the game. And I think, you know, I do appreciate the people who are behind the scenes working on this, getting paid not enough. My paid comments are mostly geared towards the managerial level of TPCI, but getting paid not enough to take RBS, I guess, from people like me.
Sam, I want to say thank you. There's been a ton of information. I know we can keep talking about a lot of things. We had to cut off the, you know, Pokemon talk before we got into the actual organized play stuff. So thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. If the people want more from you, where can they find you?
Yeah, so please follow me on Twitter at SamStoise, SamStoise. My favorite Pokemon is Blastoise. I haven't figured that out. And I guess that's all I'm on now. I'm not trying to be a content creator, although... one day I might, I don't know. I joke with some friends that once I have a child that's in the junior division, I might actually start testing more and making content and getting actually good at Pokemon again. Cause I'm forced to play. But until then, please follow me on Twitter and say hi to me at tournaments.
Myself, Twitch, Twitter, and YouTube at @Mel_Magikarp. Follow the podcast at Lake of Rage Pod. If you like Sam, be sure to let me know and maybe we'll invite him back. Who knows? But this has been another episode of the Lake of Rage podcast. We'll catch you all next week.